Hello everyone, and welcome to the Dollars and Cents podcast. This is your host Shimara, and in this episode I will be talking about one of my role models in the investment world. Okay, maybe politically not my role model, I want to be clear, but in the investment world, in the investment field, he is probably in the top five. Okay, so I have Warren Buffett, Ray Dalio, George Soros, and you can order them whichever you want, but I think Warren Buffett, George Soros, Ray Dalio, and David Swensen are the greatest investors. I wouldn't rank either, you know, I can rank any of them, all of them are number one, on the number one list, but they are the top three best investors that I know of, which is Ray Dalio, David Swensen, and Warren Buffett. Charlie Munger is also one of my heroes in the investment field, and I would say those four are the main ones, main investors. So, but in this episode, I want to talk about George Soros specifically, who he is, his trading strategy, and what he's known for. So he's best known for, he's the most famous hedge fund manager in history, I would say. Because even people who are not aware of the hedge fund industry or do not know hedge fund managers, they know George Soros, because he is known as the guy who broke the Bank of England. He had a short position in the sterling pound, and because of that short position, he made $1 billion in profit in one day. He's a macro investor, so he looks at macro trends, economic trends. He's also known for the theory of reflexivity and fallibility. It's just a theory that states that there are always feedback loops in the system, that markets are not efficient, market is inefficient, so he goes against the efficient market hypothesis, which I also believe, and I support the theory wholeheartedly, that markets are inefficient. That's why we have bubbles. We have a crisis. We have a financial crisis like 2008, 1999, 1987, I mean the 70s, and 1929. So all these financial bubbles, all throughout history, you know, if you read history, you'll see the panic of 1800s, the panics, there's a few periods where there are panics. So all of those are signs that markets are inefficient. So when you talk about inefficiency, basically the theory of the efficient market hypothesis postulates that markets are efficient, right? So everything is priced in, all information, everyone has equal information, and everything is priced into assets, which is not true. We saw in 2008, the real estate asset bubble that popped and caused the financial crisis, worldwide financial crisis, not just in the US. So every market has feedback loops, okay? According to reflexivity, every market, every assets, they have feedback loops. They're properties of feeding themselves. So the fundamentals, it also postulates that people's perceptions, investors' perceptions affect fundamentals. So that is reflexivity. So investors' perceptions affect fundamentals. So if investors believe that a company, for example, earnings, they expect its earnings to increase, they will start buying the company and the stock price will increase. And as the stock price increases, the company is able to borrow more from banks, and is able to issue more shares because the prices are increasing, stock price is increasing, and so it has access to a lot of capital. So it can borrow more capital, it can issue more shares, issue more debt bonds. Now the company has more capital in its war chest, firepower that it can use to increase its earnings again. It can pay more in marketing, it can open up new factories, buy more assets, and earnings increase because the capital's, and it feeds on itself. Because earnings increase, investors see that, oh, our expectations are right, and they keep buying, and the capital, they have more access to more capital. So it's a feedback loop that occurs until it is unsustainable. If you can see, it's very unsustainable. And he explains this, he said in the 1960s there was a conglomerate boom, and it was an equity boom, equity leverage. He says there's two types of leverage, there's debt leverage and equity leverage. So that was equity leverage. So what happened was that these conglomerates, companies started acquiring other companies, and the earnings started increasing. And because the earnings started increasing, investors started buying more shares, and they had more access to capital, and then they started increasing them. But they bought more companies again. So as they had more access to capital, because investors believed that the earnings were increasing, they kept buying other companies. They kept buying earnings. And it was a feedback loop that fed on itself and fed on itself until it all collapsed. So it's a boom. So you have this bubble. Everything, prices go up, and then it reaches a twilight period, and then it reverses again. So you have, you can think of a slope. So the feedback loop feeds on itself. It reinforces itself. There's two sides to it. It's asymmetrical. He describes it as asymmetrical because the long side, as it goes up, prices goes up, it has a long runway. But as it comes down really fast. So it's asymmetrical, it's not symmetrical. It crashes really fast because people start selling the shares, and it reinforces itself in the opposite direction. So that is basically the theory of reflexivity. Fallibility is that perception, right? People perceive things. So not everyone has all the information all the time. And if you think about it, it's true. Not everyone knows everything all the time, right? So not everyone has all the information all the time. So people do not, they make decisions on uninformed or partially informed. Each decision is partially informed, right? They do not make decision based on the full information of companies. They want to invest in a company or whatever it is that they want to decide on. They don't have all the information all the time. It's impossible to have all the information all the time. And that is a philosophy that George Soros adopted from another philosopher when he was in the London Business School. I'll have to look up the name of the philosopher again. But that's the philosopher that, you know, he adopted the theory of reflexivity from. And he used it in the markets. So he made money during the conglomerate boom. He saw the theory in play. He used it in a real estate boom again. And he made money in the real estate market. Not buying houses and all that, but in the real estate investment trust, I believe. And you know, all the other economic crisis, even in the time that he broke the Bank of England, it was a different case. I mean, it was similar. The theory of reflexivity was in work, but that was all Stan Druckenmiller, his portfolio manager. Stan Druckenmiller is another legend as well that I admire so much. He's also in the top five. So I would say Stan, George Soros, Charlie Munger, and Warren Buffett, Ray Dalio are the top five investors that I respect most, I admire, and all my strategies, I model after these guys, all my philosophies, and they all align. Three of them are macro investors, two are value investors, so those are the guys that I look up to, and David Swensen as well. And so I'll say three of them are value investors and three of them are macro investors. Long-term investors, short-term investors. But investors basically, Ben Graham gave a good definition of investor, which is promises of safety, of capital, that's one, and a satisfactory return. That is what makes you an investor as opposed to a speculator. So an investor not only looks at satisfactory returns, but also looks at the safety of his capital. So risk management is an important factor, risk and return, not just return. whereas most people just look at return. And so George Soros, that's his trading strategy. He looks at, is based on his philosophy. So he sees that if there's a bubble brewing and he sees that the trend is strong enough to continue increasing, he's gonna buy. And if he sees that the bubble has reached its climax, its twilight part, and it's about to reverse, it's gonna it's gonna short sell. So it's gonna go on the short side. And that's what happened with England. Okay, England, what happened was England had a tough economy, and because England had a tough economy, the government needed to decrease interest rates, right? But because, you know, they were connected to the European Union currency mechanism. I'll have to look that up again, I'm sorry. I'm just making this episode on the top of my head, so bear with me, forgive me. And Europe was connected with that, so all the currencies in the European Union were connected. So you cannot increase or decrease interest rates without affecting another currency in another European country. So Germany had a high interest rate. And Germany, in the past, Weimar Republic, Germany, you remember in the 1930s, had an inflation, hyperinflation problem due to war reparations. They had to pay a lot of that in a foreign currency. They couldn't print the foreign currency. So investors left the country. Capital flow flowed out of the country, and that caused the German mark, I believe, its currency, to depreciate in value. And because it depreciated so much because of capital flight, it caused hyperinflation. So the only thing that causes hyperinflation is when you have so much foreign debt that you cannot repay. So you have to print more money. So the central bank and the government has to print more money to pay those debt. And when you print more money, you devalue your currency. So it causes everything else in the country, all the prices to increase. And I think hyperinflation, the prices increase, doubles every 5 or 10 times in a day. So it's a very extreme case. And so because of that, Germany understood that it did not want hyperinflation. So it did not want to decrease its interest rates. It wanted its interest rate to be high. And that affected England as well, because now currencies were falling. People were starting to save in Germany, German currency. And so England needed to increase its interest rates as well to counter that. But as it increased its interest rates, remember, the economy is already struggling, right? Especially the real estate sector. So every time they increased the interest rates, it really affected the real estate sector in England. So it was unsustainable. They couldn't defend currency flowing out, capital flowing out of England into Germany. And so they had to defend the currency. And there's only two ways to defend the currency. Central bank increases interest rates and it spends down reserves. So it uses its foreign reserves, which is just its savings account, to buy its own currency, to cushion the outflow of capital out of the country. But it's unsustainable because they already have an economy that's already hurting. So they have no choice but to stop spending down reserves and decrease interest rates. And what that will do is that will allow the devaluation of the currency. And George Soros and Stan Druckenmiller saw that, and they saw that it was inevitable, right? It was inevitable. England had to cut ties with Germany and decrease its rates because the population, the economy was already hurting. And while it was hurting, the interest rates were high. So the risk reward there was amazing. It was an asymmetrical risk reward. Because if they spend on reserves, they only had limited reserves. They would run out of reserves. The interest rates would be high. Company would be hurting. And this is what happens with countries that don't have reserve currencies as well. So they had no choice but to decrease interest rates. And Stan Druckenmiller and George Soros saw that opportunity 4 or 5 months prior to that. And so the risk reward was very attractive that they had to leverage up, I think 2 times or 1.5 times the entire fund capital, because the risk reward was amazing. I mean, if you look at it, if interest rates were high and central banks kept spending down reserve, all they would lose was transaction costs, because it was highly liquid. Currency markets are highly liquid. So they would have lost 2 to 3% of capital. That's amazing. If they were right, they would have made 100x. I mean, 100%. They would have doubled their money. So they leveraged up $10 billion and made... They were right. After, I think, 2 or 3 months, England devalued the currency, and from that, they made $1 billion in a day in profit. So that is how they traded. And they, the same strategy they used to make another $1 billion or $2 billion from Thai currency after the England coup, I would say. After they made $1 billion from England, they broke the Bank of England, and then they moved to Thai, and they did the same thing with Thai, and they did it 3 or 4 other times. And this is a brilliant strategy, because after they made $1 billion from these currencies, remember, because currencies devalue and the prices go down so much, right? Assets become really cheap, because capital already, all the capital flow out of the country, all the assets are really cheap, equity is cheap. So they took that $1 billion and they bought assets again, equities. And at the end of the year, they made another $1 billion, $2-3 billion. So that is just a short update on George Soros. Thank you all for, he's one of my role models. You guys should go read up on him. Thank you all for listening to this episode, and see you all in the next episode.